Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
It's true. Don't call him a liar unless you want to be a liar yourself, in which case, go ahead, call him a liar, and we'll call you a liar, and we'll have the tape to prove it.
On backup vocals, Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
When we do the remix, it's going to sound awesome. Trust me. Gentlemen, I am ready to get into some quantum strangeness here, and I want everybody to bear with me. I'm going to give a little bit of a backstory and kind of set things up, and then we're going to dive into a strange discussion that may then lead to a mass Weird Things experiment I will propose and discuss with you guys to get your input on, if that's cool.
Sure. But, I mean, first of all, can you disavow that we're being paid by the Disney Corporation to have all of our stories be strange on this, the premiere weekend of the United States release of Doctor Strange? Now
no, actually,
in theaters?
We're supported by the Asylum Video direct release PhD candidate Weird. Yeah.
No, there was I saw on Cargill, who is our friend and wrote Doctor Strange. He did a big podcast about a direct to video. It was like Doctor Mordred or something.
Oh yeah, Doctor Mordred. As a matter of fact, they showed that in the pre-show for Doctor Strange. Apparently, this guy had gotten the rights to Doctor Strange, had written a Doctor Strange movie, and then at some point everything fell through and he couldn't secure it to do it. So he's like, well, screw it. Now it's Dr. Mordred. And it's just so very clearly Doctor Strange when you watch the trailer. And it's pretty terrible.
Listen, we all have dreams, but I'm going to get into the discussion of dreams in just a moment, but a little bit of background first. Years ago, Roger Penrose, he may be somebody familiar to many of you because of when you talk about Penrose tiles, a number of interesting mathematics. He's a mathematician, mathematical physicist, a very, very brilliant guy, but known for some sort of controversial and interesting theories and stuff. Years ago, he suggested the idea that the human brain could be functioning on some sort of quantum level, and thinking that perhaps some of the ways the brain works, the human brain work, could maybe only be explained by quantum effects. And he talked about the idea of these sort of vesicles or these tubules in the brain that could be sensitive to sort of quantum effects or whatever. All very, very theoretical. I, at the time when this was sort of getting its sort of first kind of round of attention, I had I had the opportunity to talk to Marvin Minsky. Marvin Minsky, mathematician, father of artificial intelligence, who passed away last year. Really, really interesting guy. We used to have speak at the Amazing Meetings, and that was always great. Whenever we put on those Amazing Meetings for James Randi's Foundation, I got to just pester these brilliant people with my stupid questions. And I remember asking Marvin Minsky about that, about what he thought about Penrose's thing, and Minsky made a very interesting observation, and that was that if you're trying to have like total complete randomness, you don't need to have a quantum generator to do that. You can do what's called pseudo randomness, where you have this, you know, you can create a pseudo random number that to the universe it's effectively random because no computer in the universe would ever be able to figure out the source of it, which is a whole other discussion unto itself. And as skeptics, we're kind of into the idea of like, you don't need to, don't invent complicated explanations when simple ones work. And that's Occam's razor going back to there. That's not to mean to say the more complicated explanation doesn't come into play, but if it's a really complicated one and you don't need it, then why go there? That being said, the idea that the human brain could be influenced by quantum events hasn't died. And there have actually been some interesting, some studies that talked about there's a protein called rhodopsin, which is like what gives us like photosensitivity in the eye, that the rhodopsin molecule or rhodopsin protein could be like sensitive to one quantum event, like one photon, one electron, one quantum event could actually trigger that and could actually create some sort of effect that could be measurable by the human nervous system. That was sort of an interesting thing. And now, as we've been studying photosynthesis and the way smell works, there's been research that says that we may actually have in biological systems rely upon quantum events, quantum systems, and being able to like be able to process the way light energy or sense things and whatever. There's a growing body of evidence that, our bodies may be quantum, and not in that sort of pseudoscientific claptrappy kind of everything is energy and dumb things like that, but in actual measurable ways that could happen. Well, it's a fascinating idea to think like, man, maybe our brains work on some quantum level, which makes us a little bit mysterious and interesting. I've never put a whole lot of stock into it because I don't think the supporting evidence has been there. But there's some new proposals have come out, which is sort of interesting. And this is from a physicist, Matthew Fisher. And Fisher had taken the idea of the quantum brain, or that we're somehow like can be influenced by quantum events, and came about it from a very different point of view and has a rather interesting sort of theory to base this upon. He was suffering from depression, and going through depression, you know, you try different drugs if you have to go that route, if that's what's, you know, viable. And he found a drug that worked for him, and it was lithium based. A number of brain drugs are lithium based. And he was curious, you know, because he realized he wanted to study how did it work. And they realized that a lot of these treatments, we just don't know how they work. They just work. We try something treating people for one thing. We find out that it has an effect somewhere else. We make sure it's not going to kill you or mutate you or whatever. And then we say, okay, we'll put it out on the market. But as a physicist, he was fascinated by the idea that this drug worked. And he was wondering if perhaps there was some other kind of effect going on there beyond just a regular chemical effect. Was there some different effect that could take place? And it turns out that lithium has a couple different kinds of isotopes. Some of them, you know, one is, you know, has, you know, a different isotopic form than others, which from a chemical point of view, you can have different isotopes. They are effectively the same. The body can't tell the difference. There's absolutely no difference as far as the way the body handles it because chemically it's the same. He found a study, though, where they compared two different kinds of lithium. Let me get the precise versions here, lithium 6 and lithium 7, to see if there was actually a difference when they tried that in some sort of medical treatment, to see if there was a different effect on the behavior of, in this case, the behavior of rats. And they found that one group was given lithium 7, one group was given lithium 6, and a third was a control group. And it turned out that the mother rats that received lithium 6 showed much stronger maternal behaviors. Okay. So what this was is it showed that there was some sort of property that took place, even though this is supposed to be chemically the same, and it would behave differently on effectively a quantum level. Now, this study, to my knowledge, not been replicated. This study could be totally bogus or whatever. There could be other experimental error or something like that. But if it's true, it's a very, very interesting thing because it says that this thing worked not just because it was lithium, because the isotopic version of lithium was different. And so this led him into the idea of maybe there is some sort of quantum effect taking place in the brain. He started elaborating from there, thinking about what kind of mechanisms would have to come into play, and has now built up his own theory as to how our brains may actually really be influenced and work. Our processing, our cognition could function on some sort of quantum level, which is what I want to bring you up to here now. Came and is a fringe. We're talking about, well, there's a study here that said this, and based upon this, there's so many reasons why this could go astray. But the implications for this are fascinating because it means that we take brains out of just being these sort of very systems that we can reduce to a chemical and regular sort of understanding from how normal biology works, and it puts them into the realm of physics and quantum entanglement in qubits and other sort of things.
Man, lots to parse here.
Yes.
The first thing is that I think when you read this kind of study, it's very, very tempting, and it sounds like the author of the study certainly has dived down the rabbit hole. Here's what we know. There exists one study in which the idea that isotopes of a certain chemical instead of the chemical itself yields different behavioral results, right? That's all we know. So we still have to have it replicated. We still have to have other people verify it. We have to try all different kinds of derivations of this idea to see if it actually does anything. But, you know, of course, that doesn't keep minds from wandering. And all of a sudden it's like, well, let me make up a theory of how quantum effects, you know, shape the mind or whatever. But having said all of that, I don't know that there's any reason to discount this because these are factually different molecules going into a biological system that verifiable. And, you know, to announce that surprise, you get slightly different results out of those chemicals going in. That's not the craziest thing either.
I mean, it is from a chemistry point of view. It is. You should not be able to know that. I mean, you would. It's in a biological systems. They function. They're supposed to function exactly the same. The only way you would have any sort of difference is if there was some sort of other like quantum thing going on. Because chemically, they behave exactly the same.
Sure, sure. I guess my point is, just as there is a gap between Newtonian physics and quantum physics. Now it may be that we are discovering in biological chemistry a gap between, this kind of lithium isotope versus traditional lithium or whatever. And again, I'm just sort of seeding all that ground and just saying, let's say all of that is true. What does that mean? All of this strikes me, and forgive me if I'm just, you know, demonizing unfairly, because I might be. And part of it is my annoyance because quantum, like the brain is a complicated critter and there's a lot we don't understand about it. And there's a lot we don't understand about quantum physics. And so every pseudoscientific hack just wants to say, well, here's one thing I don't understand and another thing I don't understand. Let's say the two are under the same umbrella or whatever. And it's very hard to let go of the prejudice associated with all that. Ultimately, let's say everything is 100% true. Ultimately, what does this mean? It means that the brain is susceptible to what it's fed, whether it be chemical, isotopic, quantum, or informational, right? I mean, does it change much?
Oh, it changes everything. It changes the way it works. It means that if the way that we work and the way our brain processes information is similar to a quantum computer, it means is that you can't reduce certain things just for how we understand them from a chemical or a present biological means. Is that you try to replicate the systems, you won't be able to because the thing you don't think is important is actually absolutely critically important, and that are trying to understand. It's a whole other view of brain science. It changes fundamentally the idea of it just being this. Neurons do this, whatever, because he gets into talking about trying to figure out there is a lot of ifs and nuts. And if you ask me to bet money on whether or not I think this is true, I'm going to say, no, I don't. I don't think it's true.
Well, I guess, just so we keep in the same clubhouse. So because you're right, that would be huge because it would fundamentally change the way we understand the way the brain works. But in terms of, right now, if I asked, why'd you punch that giraffe? You're going to say, anything from, a giraffe beat my mom up once to I didn't have breakfast this morning to this guy, offered me $100 if I'd punch a giraffe. There's like causality. There's a reason you did a thing, right? I guess what I'm getting at is the reductionist view of the universe, the idea of causality, the idea that that we do things because of reasons that exist. And this is always the part where when I ask whether or not free will is an illusion, everybody goes to quantum and says, well, quantum, it's totally random. You can't possibly predict, reasons, it's indefinable or whatever. But to me, that doesn't solve anything because either you punched that giraffe because you had a very good reason, or you did it because the quantum dice rolled this way and told you needed to punch a giraffe. Either way, free will is still an illusion.
Well, but Brian, I mean, if we were to have a discussion about free will, we've got to parse several things. We got to start with what we mean by that. We'd have to parse so many different things before we even get to an answer what that is. And we will probably diverge before we even get there on what our explanations for what those things
are.
Sure,
totally agreed. And by the way, I apologize that this is the first place that I'm going. I know this is not the core focus of this study, but it does just, it seems like again and again, and I find myself in discussions about what constitutes, this idea of that who is the you that's in charge of you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we have one of the biggest problems we have to deal with, and one of the underlying problems of every civilization deals with is mental illness. Mental illness is when you talk about homeless, chronic homelessness, drug abuse, and a lot of other things, these things come down to very often mental illness problems. And we are very ineffective at trying to treat these things. We found some things in people who have depression or imbalances. We found like lithium, some things like that work. Some things kind of help a little bit, but we still don't know. And that's been what it's been troubling. But if you all of a sudden say, hey, there's an entirely new part of how the brain works that we have been unaware of and we've ignored that could affect us dramatically. It has a fundamental change. And when it comes to, regardless of the actions of free will or whatever, we know that people who make good decisions and people make bad decisions, their brains work differently. There are things at play that are very different than that. You know, people who are, you know, have give obsessive compulsive behaviors, people prone to schizophrenia, other things like that. There are physical things that we say, okay, we can see there's a difference there. We don't know how to change that or affect that. That has short term, this could have implications there. This could have dramatic implications there. I mean, again, if it's true, and that's the whole purpose of this podcast, is we're going to say, hey, let's follow this thread all the way through. We're normally skeptics to be like, bullshit, we want more proof. You know, let's be right. Like, well, if this, then what? And I think it's a without even getting to like, you know, free will or systems like that. There are, and this isn't even like the really crazy part that I want to get to, but, we don't
know. Well, what's the crazy part then?
Well, so the other part of this and where I share the knee-jerk reaction whenever we hear quantum stuff or whatever, because it drives me nuts to hear people talk about like, well, you know, energy and matter are the same thing. And it's like, toilet bowl cleaner and Skittles are the same thing. Then which one do you want to eat? You know, I'm going to guess you're not going to want to eat the toilet bowl cleaner, I hope, unless it's, you know, just a bag full of, you know, sour Skittles. So point is that, you know, we get frustrated by this, these discussions with people who have kind of low information points of view on this and sort of these equivalencies. That being said, if we're going to just temporarily step into a window here, is step through the window and embrace some of this crazier stuff, the crazier idea of, let's say the brain is quantum in some effect and it can be sensitive to stuff. And then if we get into the idea of like, there are quantum universes out there, what happens when you have two brains that are very, very similar? You know, is the brain able to do these sort of weird sort of, you know, collapsing sort of wave functions and try to do, you know, build up its sort of models. So we talk about how a way the brain works is we sort of build up this model of how we think things will be. And then as evidence does, we talk about collapsing wave functions and stuff. It just opens up other discussions.
So what is the predominant theory as far as like split universes I've heard stuff like the very idea that every time you're faced with any kind of decision gate, just as a particle of light, takes both pathways, your decision, you know, you actually in different universes execute both of those. Is that all just pops IBS, or is there legit theories behind that?
Everett multi-roles hypothesis. That was his sort of hypothesis, was that it's that the way to account for why does it make one choice and not the other? Why does it go through one slip, the other, not the other? It goes through both. You know, it just, but that's the universe branches off into this other sort of, you know, that splits. There's another universe there. And, you know, that's, you can get into the idea of like, you know, are there other universes that are slightly similar to ours or whatever? And if as a science fiction writer, you know, you start thinking about the idea of like, okay, if our brain is this quantum system, you know, and when I dream at night, you know, what if part of that is, you know, you're connected to temporarily somebody else where things are slightly the same, but a little bit different.
Man, that would be a tangible benefit, a tangible difference between the two. Justin, where's your head at on the idea that your brain is affected, yes, with the chemistry of the foods you eat, and yes, with the input of knowledge that you put into it, but also, you know, because of this cosmic roll of the dice of whether or not something is an isotope and quantum effects are guiding you one way or another?
You got any gum? I don't even really know where to even start with something like this, because you know, the brain, as I understand it, certainly is something that is very complicated and something that I do not personally know enough of how it works to say, well, this is totally off the reservation crazy. I mean, the idea that what would my first question would be, if it were tomorrow proven to be true that these theories are correct, is really the question of, like, how we understand brains, both their treatment through therapy or through surgery, like, how were we doing damage? How will we need to change things going forward? Yeah. Like at what level do we realize that, you know, the four humors aren't really a thing? And we should probably stop, you know, putting good blood or whatever that we just think into somebody's body, or sucking stuff out with leeches.
So if you want a concrete, tangible example of something very similar to it, you know, around the 1940s, nobody knew that lead had such toxic neurological side effects on it. We were putting lead in everything. And then meanwhile, we were poisoning our bodies, poisoning our children, poisoning everything. And then, what was it, the 1950s or 60s, when all of a sudden it's just like, pretty sure this lead's real bad for all of us. And we're affecting our brains and our decisions. There's even theories like aspects of the Cold War were escalated because, according to some scientists, everybody was lead poisoned, which made them dumb and insane and more aggressive than they should be. What if we're on the cusp of something like that, where we discover something that you know, by the numbers, the chemists tell us, well, this lithium, that lithium, whatever, doesn't matter. But it turns out that we're ingesting the wrong isotopes of a billion different things.
Yeah, because it's what's interesting is we get into, like, taste and smell, maybe quantum, may have a quantum basis on there. And when you start getting into that idea, and it's a big, it's such a big leap, but I don't think we're ready just to jump and go, yep, this is how the world works. But it's worth looking into, because what you just said is that if nature uses a system for one thing, nature can use a system for a lot of things. And, you know, it's 2016 and we're just starting to appreciate the fact that the bacteria that lives in our stomach and our digestive tract may affect our health. You know, that, you know, that's going to be, you know, looked back upon as sort of this sort of barbaric sort of, like, yeah, they just kind of thought, yeah, they're just there. Does it really make a difference? Now, I'm going to take where Penrose gets really, really kind of gets really crazy is Penrose has said that he thinks that he talks about these sort of microtubules in the brain in which sort of inhabit the quantumness sort of takes place there. Again, this is like, we all are in agreement. This is crazy. But let's just entertain this idea. He thinks these microtubules in the brain, when the body gets destroyed, that information's still out there. And then if you rebuild the body, the information comes back.
That's some weird, wild stuff.
So what does that mean in terms of, and this is always the problem with the Star Trek replicator, right? Is, you know, what's the difference between a transporter and a replicator? If we could build a version of you that's, you know, correctly quantum entangled, could we build another of you exactly as entangled?
Yeah. And I don't, you know, the problem with that theory, it's like, we don't, well, what's the difference between a me where the quantumness magic stuff, the secret sauce doesn't come back, and a me where it does, you know, is that what you do you not boot up? You know, like, I don't know, but it's this, you know, it gets into these sort of stranger, sort of weird sort of discussions. And I think that if we, and it's just having the whole, well, maybe it's quantum two kind of thing hangover discussions as we're trying to build more sophisticated artificial intelligence is good, but, you know, it hasn't helped us when it, you know, well, here I'll explain this though. What's interesting. So, IBM builds computers now that, like, we have, like, Deep Blue can beat us at chess, it can beat us at Go, right? But if you compare the amount of watts the human brain uses versus the amount of watts that those computers use, no contest. We're still the most efficient computing machine, right, by a large margin.
Sure.
You know, And in theory, you know, in 20 or 30 years time, you know, we should have computers will exceed that efficiency. But that's still the biggest problem we've had is we can increase the density of transistors and, you know, at a much greater rate of just the density of neurons. But when it comes to the efficiency system, and then that's one of these things people are saying, like, well, what if we can't, you know, what if a non-quantum computer will never be able to do this, have that same rate of efficiency? It's a very, unless it uses a quantum effect, which is an interesting sort of thought. You know, that the brain is, I guess it comes back to, there's people who want to believe that we are magical, you know, that we are some sort of magical, and we call it quantum or whatever. And unless we get hold of that, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, they're not wrong to, you know, nobody's wrong who says this is a big deal. Nobody's wrong that says this changes a lot of the way we understand science. I would suggest that maybe they're wrong in that this solves anything. How about that? Is that an okay thing to say? Because if what you want to believe is like, the soul exists outside of the self, or some part of us is connected with everything else, it's like, yeah, no, that's great. But what does that mean in terms of what changes? And I suspect, well, not so much.
No, I would disagree. I would say that if these things were true, you know, if these things were true, what changes is that we'll find that our pathway towards building artificial intelligence that's more intelligent than we are and more efficient won't happen unless we build them on a quantum level. You know, right now we're not counting on having to build quantum computers to build that. And quantum computers, you know, trying to build an efficient quantum computer that could work at any scale, we still don't know how to do that. We can map out transistors, you know, densities, we can map out human brain mapping, and we can put a time frame 20 or 30 years of when they exceed us. But if there's this secret sauce that's a quantum thing, it puts that further out. So that's one of the things that changes. Another thing that changes is that, like, listen, if he's saying that this information's really out there, then it means that, like, hey, yeah, we get we can figure out how to rebuild, you know, Thomas Jefferson's brain. We get Thomas Jefferson back.
Or not even bother to actually build him, but instead build a simulation with all the appropriate quantum effects ready to go, to where all of a sudden you flip a switch and you get the simulacrum that actually knows knows.
But then philosophically, what's him?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, that's, and using Penrose's argument, you would have to build that enough of the brain, you'd have to build enough of that system for it to be like the antenna, you know, you have to build that thing for it to know, like, this is it. So it's fringy. It's weird. But I'm going to propose we embrace this with a few experiments.
Go on.
I want our listeners, one, I would love to hear some stories of people who've had dreams where they're in like a parallel life. Things were similar but different, but it felt like, hey, this felt like a sort of a somewhat similar sort of life, very, very extremely realistic, but there was something different about it, okay? And if you have a dream like that, you're in a dream like that, I want you to tell us, hey, like, you know, it's very hard to read things in dreams. It's very hard to do certain things in dreams because that part of our brain is, you know, shut off, which is why, you know, it's really not a quantum event. It's just the way our brain works. But pretending that's not true.
Right.
Find something different. You know, could you find, like, are there different movies in your Netflix queue? Different songs, different stories, different stuff. If this is a parallel universe that's a little bit different, you know, a significantly different to preserve this, can you find some details of this? Can you get some information back? We'd like to know this, you know? So one, we'd like to know if you have parallel dreams. Two, can you find something different? Can you tell us what was different in this world? Number three is an experiment, is that next time you're in a dream, we want you to tell a friend a secret, like an image or something, like show them something. Like if I were to dream and I were to run into Brian, I'd be like, Brian, I'm going to show you what's inside this box. You ready to look inside this box? I'm going to open up the box. I'm going to show you a skunk. You smell that skunk, Brian? You pet that skunk? That skunk's very, very real. The next day, I'm going to go, Brian, if I had a box, what would be inside of there?
And I'd say, a skunk.
What? Now, of course, this is not scientific. You know, this is absolutely, remember, I spent years developing actual, like, how do you test for psychic power sort of stuff. This does not count as that. This is not this. This is a way for us to get some interesting stories, you know, and look at it from that. But I thought it might be kind of fun to try to do that.
Yeah. So if people want to participate, they should write what? Neshcom?
Yeah. Send it into Neshcom at Gmail, Neshcom at gmail.com, and put weird things in the subject line, please.
Yeah. Gentlemen, the world is weird. It's very, very, very weird.
Damn straight. Yeah. Only getting weirder.
In order to keep track of all this,
stay that way. when you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, yes, friends, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this show. Why, there was a bygone era of this show where sometimes it didn't happen. That was many moons ago. But you do not want the bad old days to return, now do you? Well, to stave off the wolves, which will eventually consume us all, you can chip in your fine ducats to patreon.com/weirdthings. Make sure that we stay here on Sunday afternoons giving you the heat, the weird heat. Thank you for everybody who supports us and everybody who wants to kick in anything that they want, that they feel is appropriate for this show. We greatly appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
So here we are. We're on a little boat trip, guys. We're on a little boat trip. We decided to go to Canada, right? Canadian territory of Nunavut. We're out in our boat. And like, why are we, you know, was this sort of wild, sort of crazy? Brian called us up. He's like, guys, let's go to Canada, go for a boat ride. Like, Brian, that makes no sense. Like, hey, it came to me in a dream. Like, oh,
no.
Oh, okay.
Just so we're clear, when I brought up this dream, did I suggest that we fly to Canada and then disembark from Canada, or are we taking the boat to Canada?
We're going to Canada and getting a boat there. Probably the most efficient way to do that.
Got it.
So we're in our little boat. We're out there hanging out in the boat. And Justin's like, hey, did you hear that? Like, just the sound of the waves, just the sound of nature, just the sound of, you know, the cool breeze blowing through our hair as we just hang out in this boat, Brian's sort of kind of mindless quest that we just support him because it's what we do. If there's adventure to be found, we'll go there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, no, that was a ping. I'm like, what? Yeah, did you hear the ping? I'm like, Justin, we're in a boat. There's nothing around. And like, wait, I think I heard a hum. I'm like, what? You heard a hum now? Ooh, there's a beep. And Brian and I are looking at Justin thinking he's gone a little bit nuts. Then all of a sudden Brian's like, hey, wait, I hear the ping too. I'm like, oh man, it's contagious. We're like, oh, wait, I think I hear a humming noise too. And I'm like, wait, let's put our ears next to the hull of the boat. And sure enough, we hear a ping, a hum, and some beeps. And we're like, this is really, really weird. We go back to town. We tell some people like, hey, you know, we're out there in the Fury and Helka Strait, and we heard these, you know, we're about 75 miles northwest of the hamlet of Iqaluit, and we heard these noises. They're like, yeah, we've been hearing these noises too. Wait, what's it caused? We don't know.
Well, okay. So all we got, I mean, granted, it was a delightful boat ride outside of the strange pinging noises, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we got some strange noises. We get back to shore, and we say, we heard strange noises, and they're all like, yeah, we hear them too.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know what's so weird about this. Like, there's weird stuff going on underwater all the time. Probably some crazy robot got lost what fell in the water, and now it's just yelling for help and will forever. Like, what's the big deal?
Well, turns out we're like, hey, well, if the big deal is there's strange noses, where are they coming from? Maybe you'd say it's just Ray Robot because, you know, they're just all over the place. So,
it is Canada, after all.
We call the CDND, the Canadian Department of National Defense, and they're like, yeah, we're investigating it, you know, and they sent out a surveillance plane to check it out from above, and, you know, they're out there for a whole hour and a half, and they didn't hear anything.
So it kind of comes and goes then?
What's that?
So now we can assume that these noises come and go.
Yeah, apparently they come and go.
All right. Well, number one, let's make some money on this. We got to walk in Jaws style and just be like, well, good thing we showed up here. It'll be X amount of money to catch it and Y amount of money to kill it. Let's pony up, boys. You want to get it done before Memorial Day?
So it's one of these. Their mysterious C4 things are kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And anybody want to jump in with theories, robot, or just want me to keep going?
No, so I would say, I mean, probably the scariest would be some kind of mine or something, right? Like just some weird explosive thing that is down below and is beeping for a reason so people could find it or something, but is long forgotten and could do us harm. Otherwise, you know, I would guess maybe some sort of you know, a marine biological survey equipment or something like that. Like those would probably be my most benign and my most terrifying guesses.
And this is to be clear, like if and I hate to put you on the spot, but could you do an impression of what the sound sounds like?
All I know is they say ping, hum, beep.
Okay. Because I was going to be honest, I'm going to put my money on some kind of geological phenomenon, whether it's a certain settling of stuff.
You know, that was like there have been some, like, was it the Big Bloop or one of those weather, you know, the big sort of some of the there have been these sort of mysterious sounds that we've heard from the ocean. And then that's what it tends to be, that often it can be icebergs calving. It can be underground geothermal things. But I'll throw out my theory on this. Without knowing much about the actual area there. But, yeah, I don't think the Canadian military is responsible, but maybe the U.S. or Russian subs. You know, it could be just, you know, submarine maneuvers.
Oh, that's a really good point because, of course, neither country would have any reason to tell Canada that they're off the coast. But, of course, that tactically would make sense for both.
Yeah, and, you know, as we try to explore these, we're constantly sending things through, doing maneuvers and things like that and testing patrols, so they wouldn't tell us. You know, one of the big things is, by the way, one of my friends now is the guy whose father did Project Blue Book, which
what?
Is interesting.
What?
Yeah, Hynek's son, Paul Hynek. What's interesting, too, is that, like, we did a lot of things to do surveillance, like pre-spy satellite or being able to throw those things up there. One of the things is, you know, we know that, like, Roswell was this, you know, balloon train designed to listen in on the Soviets for atomic bombs, was the idea. If you put something in the upper atmosphere, that sound conducts its way all the way through the upper parts of the thermosphere or the troposphere. Another thing that we did that the Russians, we know this is an acknowledged thing we did, and it really irritated the Russians, was what would you do if you wanted to get, let's say, photos and stuff of Russian military bases?
I mean, you'd send over balloons or satellites or
exactly.
Planes.
We sent balloons over.
Yeah.
We would actually put cameras on balloons and just fly them over the Soviet Union, catching the right wind stream.
And then all the way over the Soviet Union, catching them when they landed back on U.S. territory. Wow.
Or at sea or wherever. Yeah. So, I mean, that was just sort of and the Russians hated the fact that, like, we were like, well, you know, we'll just use these very conducive wind streams to just sort of send these things up and over and then go catch them. And then, you know, just you think about, like, I love, like, there's the whole history of, like, espionage and using things prior to the spy satellite. Now we live in an age where we have, the government acknowledges, you know, we have spy satellites that can fly up next to other spy satellites and probably hack them.
Yeah.
You know, at any given time, the Air Force has, I think it's the X-37, whatever the little space plane, which can change its orbit and carry who knows what payloads, but what we did before then. So my bet is that there is, naval technology, you have, of course, subs, you have this, you also have things called sonobuoys, which are basically these standing sort of receivers, or these listening posts that you put in the ocean. We have tons of these out there. There are thousands of these things. We don't talk about them, but they're out there. And what they do is they listen for submarines. And so that's one of the ways in which we have our early warning network to try to figure out where the, you know, Russian subs are, is that we put these sonobuoys out there and they just sort of listen, they hang around the seafloor. And if anything floats by overhead, it transmits a signal or lets us know or records it.
Huh. So if you are the American or Russian military and you see these stories, are you like, God damn it, Steve, what did I tell you about screwing around off the coast of Ontario?
Ha!
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, that's you've happened, like, every now and then you'll hear about, like, you know, some people are in some tourist boat or whatever, and they see, like, a Russian sub surface, you know, and they're like, because they had to do some sort of emergency vent, you know. And that's, like, you know, the amount of times that, like, you know, you go to, you know, if you're in New York City or you're Miami or major port, the number of times that there are Russian or sometimes Chinese subs right out, you know, up to the line, they will go up to the line of what, you know, before they're, you know, crossing the line, that are out there. It's a lot. And the same thing. And one of the things that little food for thought, because we talk about like hacking and like, you know, the news has been of late of like the Russians hacking our computer systems, the prevalence of Chinese hackers. There's this great video, I forgot where it is, where you can actually watch, you know, a Chinese, it's watching all the intrusions from a Chinese military hacker as they're going through, you know, these different networks and looking, trying to hack stuff. I had a conversation with somebody. I said, yeah, the thing that we don't hear about, the thing that does not get discussed, it's like we need to be super vigilant, obviously, all this, but don't worry too much, because the story that's not in the headlines should make you feel slightly better. And that is, we almost never hear about our intrusions. We don't talk about what we've done with the other powers' networks. We don't talk about how much hacking we've done of them and what we do and what we know. And we are still several years ahead in a technology point of view of doing this. You know, the Pentagon gets there are 45,000 attempts a day to hack the Pentagon. It's not like we're just sitting there going, I wonder what they're up to. I don't know. How would we figure it out?
Sure.
It's me. You know, our NRO, you know, we have a more secretive agency than the NSA. We don't even know what they're up to.
Yeah, dude, the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's astonishing to me that I heard about them for the first time this year. I mean, maybe I'd heard about them before, but it's like they were not on my radar. But it's like that little act of giving away 2.5 superior Hubble telescopes because they didn't need them anymore. That's just the slightest visceral hint into what they're capable of.
Oh yeah. There was a great book years ago called The Puzzle Palace. And, I want to say late '80s, early '90s, and The Puzzle Palace went into the whole kind of the history, NSA and the NRO, talked about the NRO, which was one of these things that never got talked about. And there was this great sort of 1983, man. So that was one of the things they talk about. Well, that goes into the NSA, and then they allude to the NRO. One of the things that's very interesting is they talk about, there's a story in there about when Western Union went to lay the first transatlantic telegraph cable, they got stopped by the U.S. Navy, and the Navy said, or one of the first earliest cables, you know, wasn't like the first one. This is the Navy got stopped by the U.S. Navy, and they said, we want to put a splice in there. And Western Union's like, no, you can't do that. They're like, we're out at sea. This is a gunboat. We're putting a splice in there to monitor.
Yeah.
And Western Union's like, okay, you got a point. Let them do this. And there was a point where, like, you know, Puzzle Palace gets in. Again, this is the 80s. It gets into, like, you know, there was a point at which every single bit of telephone traffic coming from, you know, the Pacific went through one exchange in San Francisco, went to one floor, like AT&T had a floor there. There was a floor above that floor that was owned by the government. Then like the next floor was AT&T, you know, and that was
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where that was 30, 40 years ago, you know, and it goes into sort of the whole history of this thing. And like one of the things that we had was that, like, Project Echelon, which was this project of which we were trying to, you know, like, how are we like monitoring like communications in the United States of citizens? And the way Project Echelon worked, because Congress had said, mandate said that, you know, they forbid the U.S. government from doing this. You're not allowed to monitor, you know, domestic traffic or whatever. The CIA is like, well, we want to do this to some extent, which obviously didn't help when, you know, and this is years before 9/11. What Project Echelon did was there was a military base in somewhere in Virginia or somewhere like that, and they had a division there that was manned by British military. And then in Britain, there was a similar sort of facility with American authorities. And so we had the British monitor these communications so that we were not in violation of our agreement.
Man, you know, there's so many. Well, and if you think about it, it's like one of those things where it's like, you know, hey, man, we're America. We don't spy on our own people and assume that they're doing wrong. It's like, well, but, you know, what if they might be Russian spies? It's like, well, then that would fall under the jurisdiction of, you know, international espionage, and it would make sense for us to be prepared for that. It's like, well, why don't we listen to everyone just in case they're Russian spies? It's like, well, we can't do that because we're going to hear them talk about, you know, their drug deals or their kidnappings that they intend to do or whatever. And then, you know, what are we going to do? It's like, okay, well, we'll listen, but if it's not espionage, if it's not our purview, if it's not, you know, under our mandate, we'll get rid of all that. And then, of course, you know, something like a 9/11 happens and it's like, wait a minute, we had people listening this whole time and then they just flushed that data down the toilet? Well, that's dumb. Well, the only reasonable, responsible thing we should do is listen to everything and save everything that we wrote.
Yep.
And this is how it begins.
Well, I mean, it began 100 years ago. I mean, but it's exactly the point was, is that we were very in the abstract. We're like, no, we shouldn't do this. We'll do this. We won't intervene. We won't, you know, CIA can't do this because of this, whatever, you know, can't operate domestically, whatever. Okay. And then exactly as you said, this happened. Like, why didn't you do this? Well, you told us not to. Yeah, but we didn't mean in this case.
It's like, yeah.
Well, okay.
It's just the burden of knowledge, right? And where do we draw those lines? And where do we as a populace feel comfortable of another organizing, organized, highly efficient body looking into stuff? Like, it's just, yeah, it's so weird what those lines are in abstract as compared to like, yeah, no, we want to preserve these relationships. But like, what if it would stop 9/11? What's 9/11? Oh, it's this the horrifying thing. Oh my God, that's crazy. Yes, of course, stop 9/11 by any means necessary.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I think that the big argument always comes down to me, like the deciding factor is it's not so great. It's you need to have, you know, you need to have oversight. You need to have a body that's not rubber stamp oversight. You need to have some sort of legal sort of system in place, you know, like, you know, there's a difference between like, and there's big news in the late about these prosecutor subpoenas, you know, state prosecutors issuing the subpoenas, which was previously something that was sort of like only judges could do. And now you have these prosecutors saying, we want you to turn over all this sort of stuff. And it's like, well, what's the legal framework for that? You know, you're basically going to look for anything to go after me with. And if you don't, normally you have to go to a judge and say, here's our credible evidence to do that. And, you know, there's checks and balances are a good thing. I know it's kind of crazy talk, but very crazy talk.
Yeah, you know, it's you know, one of the biggest things that I think came out after 9/11 was so much of how, you know, the complicated and certainly in the case of 9/11 damaging relationship that those intelligence agencies have with each other. And I think that part of it is when you mix that kind of highly competitive professionalism with the kind of information that you're talking about, you know, and it's hard to even, you know, like, so, all right. So they're competitive with each other and they want to make sure that, that they would love nothing more than to call shenanigans on one of the other internal organizations for overstepping their bounds. But then like, when does that become destructive? Like, when does that become counterproductive?
True. But you know what is productive?
What's that?
Well, I mean, up until Brian got himself killed.
Yeah, by the way, my ghost is having a blast. It's floating all around.
No, you're not dead. You were just like, you know, whoever shot you, I'm blindfolded, but I'm suspecting that they did it because you wouldn't stop yelling. But then it was revealed that maybe you were just in limbo.
I don't know if I'm actually dead or not, but I certainly think I'm dead, and I'm having a great time.
Totally dead.
So last time on Journey Quest, Justin and Brian got renditioned by some sort of secretive medical facility that Justin, the eternal optimist, thought it was a great idea to flag down the black helicopter that had already murdered one group of people in front of him and flame torched them.
Yeah. Justin, the black helicopters were getting us anyway. Like they, we were at a dead end with a bunch of children, of sick kids.
Like, Justin, I used to be like you, alive. Sensitive about decisions I made.
I'm not listening to dead ass Brian, this dumb ghost. I'm not even going to do it. Like, so number one, I feel, listen, it was a gamble and it didn't pay off. And now all those kids are dead. And I feel bad about that. But I'm just tired of taking crap because Brian's idea was to hide in the desert and hold up little Wile E. Coyote signs to make fun of me while he hid behind a bush with no food and no water and no transportation. So like congratulations. That was the other brilliant scheme. Like,
I want to do a series called like Time Travels with Justin, you know. It's like 1939. We're walking through a Polish neighborhood. It looks kind of rough. I'm like, dude, like, this is kind of sketchy. I don't know what we need to do. And we hear bootsteps, and Justin's like, oh, look at those gentlemen over there and the nice uniforms and the armbands. Let's go talk to them. All right.
Come on. I don't feel like all right, listen. The way that I understood the situation.
Justin's helping his black friend through the South, the Underground Railroad. They get lost in somewhere. Hey, there's a light on in that house. Let's go ask them for directions.
Jeez, the omniscient narrator's got a real bag of sass to bring this edition of Journey Quest here. Let's move it along.
My ethereal form pats you twice on the shoulder and nods understandingly.
So,
without knowing why, I just brush off my shoulder. Like
you feel like a spider of annoyance on your shoulder.
So, you guys have been there. You put inside of these body pouches. You're inside of some sort of room. You heard perhaps a fan of yours talking to you, and then he wouldn't shut up. And then there was a bullet. Brian decided that he was going to argue vociferously for his rights. And there may have been a gunshot or something, and Brian may be dead. We don't know. Brian could be in some sort of nebulous sort of state. And right now, for those of you who are not watching on our video stream, Brian is in this ghostly ethereal form. He's sort of there, sort of not there.
Justin. All right.
I'm not I'm not listening to dead ass Brian. So internal monologue, let's just log this for later. I think that there is something to the fact that we keep running into fans of the show on this journey. Initially, I just thought it was shoddy writing as a way to continue to give us enhanced personal stakes at every turn. But now that it's happened at every little outpost on some level, big or small, I feel like this is significant. I don't know what to do with it yet, but I am noting for the record that I am now a believer of this theory.
All right. So Justin, your body bag gets dragged across the floor.
Okay.
Pulled into a room. You're put into a chair, slunked up into a chair, kind of like hung on a hook sort of thing, but you can kind of feel like you're sitting upright. Okay. Yeah. Actually against a wall. You're just sort of hung against the wall. They undo the zipper. And there is a desk in front of you, and there's a bright light. It's a dark room, dank room, whatever. It looks like there's some blood stains on the floor. There's a very, very dank room there, okay?
Okay.
And there's somebody behind the light, and you can kind of see maybe the glistening reflection of a firearm or something. They seem to be like two guys in the corners there. You catch the glint off of a face shield on the person in back of the desk who's got a bunch of files in front of him. He says, okay. What's your name?
Justin Young.
Justin Young, the porn star, or Justin Robert Young, the podcaster?
Justin Robert Young, the porn star. I mean, as far as you know, asshole. No, I'm Justin Robert Young, the podcaster, not Justin Young, the singer or the porn star.
He starts making notes, talks into a microphone. The patient took an unusually long amount of time to answer that question, maybe experiencing some forms of early onset dementia.
Okay, whatever.
Now he's irritable.
Next question, face shield.
Now he's getting extremely irritable, maybe facing the early onset symptoms of aggression.
All right, I do my best to ethereally sneak up and see if I can maybe...
Brian, you can't. You cannot ethereal do that. You cannot do that.
All right, well, I'm trying to. Just know
you
that.
You try.
I'm trying try. Real hard.
Will you embrace the whole quantumness and everything else?
It's fine. I curse the isotopes that fed my brain into deficiency.
No, you're trapped. You're trapped. You're trapped in your deterministic future, Brian.
Got it. No, it's fine. It's fine.
We'll find out. We'll find out your fate, if there is a fate. So all right. They're like, all right, this guy's very aggressive. Every now and then, he seems to be under the impression he's talking to his dead friend. You
know? All right, that's whatever. Keep going. Make your things. Ask me the questions you need to ask.
So, Mr. Young. Right now, presently, you appear not to be infected.
Yeah.
What were you doing out in the desert?
I was trying to make my way to find family and friends from where I met up with other survivors in Texas, and we were making our way west.
What you, so those people you met, you knew they were infected, right?
The people on the bus?
Yes.
We had heard that there was a cure and we were trying to take them there.
Could you explain to me, like, cure? So what cure? What cure do you know about a cure?
All we know is what a hermit had had told us earlier that day, and realizing that the bus was going to be seized by the marauders that you guys killed, we tried to take physical action to find out, assess who they were, and then realizing that they were sick and that we were immune, we wanted to go investigate this cure.
Well, we found some syringes in the wreckage of the bus. Could you explain what those were?
Oh, there was this crazy dude, man. Like, he was just nuts. And he wanted to infect my friend Brian. And Brian was really down with it for a shockingly long amount of time. And then eventually didn't do it. We realized that guy was just a crazy old kook and wasn't a doctor, nothing.
Right. Could you explain what he thought his cure was?
He wanted to inject our blood into the blood of the sick, or into the bloodstream of the sick kids.
What makes you think there's a cure in your blood?
I don't know. That was that crazy old guy. We didn't wind up working with him. Like we bounced out of the 11th hour.
Now, if you did have an immunity, how would you explain that?
I don't know how we would explain it. It would be our heart. We would have the heart of a champion.
The patient is looking off into the side as if
it was the blood in our heart that keeps on pumping as it pumps for America, even in these trying times.
All right. So, Variancer, we're going to come back to you in a moment. And meanwhile,
wait, who are you? Can I ask you questions? Who the hell are you?
You do not get to ask me questions. I mean, you can ask me questions.
Hold on, wait a minute. I'm taking notes. Respondent took a long amount of time to realize whether or not he had clearance to tell me who
he was. And a soldier steps forward and zips up your bag.
Yeah. Hold on, wait a minute. I'm still writing.
You hear the sound of a door shut.
Shows extreme
you're all
science,
alone by yourself. All right. Meanwhile. Brian, fate of Brian. Where is Brian in this world right now? Brian is in this dream of which he's trying to talk to Justin. He's talking to reach out to everybody. He wished dearly he had not ridiculed Andrew's whole maybe we talk to each other in quantum dreams theory that not even Andrew believed. But Brian is having his second thoughts of, oh my gosh, what if it's all quantum? What if my only chance of connecting to this world is through that?
I start rolling dice, imaginary dice in my mind. Oh, there's 7. There's 9. Because that's all I know about quantum theory is that it's random. So I think if I imagine some random dice rolls, maybe something will come up.
All right. So all of a sudden, you start to feel your skin is cold. You start to feel a sensation. You haven't felt anything in a while.
No. Yeah, I do.
You start to open up your eyes, but it's very bright. It's very, very, very bright. You can't see anything. And you're like, I was wrong. This is heaven. You start apologizing profusely.
Yeah, no. Well, I assume this is the light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm about to, be greeted by a warm, inviting character who's going to take me on a tour of my new digs.
Instead, you see this sweaty face looking down at you through the visor of a biological security suit.
All right.
And somebody is rifling through your pockets.
I don't know what you're looking for, but it's a little to the left.
And then the voice says, he's alive. It just glanced off his forehead. How many times do I have to tell you how to double tap somebody in the head?
All right,
Frank.
I reach up to my head to examine my wounds, make sure that this guy's right.
With both of your zip-tied hands, remember your zip-tied.
Okay, yeah, no, I move both of my zip-tied hands up and start feeling.
You feel blood, it stings, and you're that.
Okay, all right. But then I look at the zip ties, and what kind of zip ties are they?
They're plastic zip ties. They're plastic. I mean, they're like regular. They're not fancy schmancy zip ties. Those are like regular ass zip ties. And like this guy in the security suit's like, this guy's secure. I'm going to leave him. Did you search him? I searched him good enough. Okay. I'm going to go now. All right. And he steps over. There's a lot. It was like 30 or 40 other people in there who are like, you're kind of moving around in body bags and stuff. He's like, all right, let's go. Food trucks here. Cool. Right.
Yeah. Brian looks directly in the camera and says, it looks like it's time for some viral marketing.
And then after I say that and give a big old wink, I pull off my rogue's ring and whisper
hey,
to myself.
Hey, what about the guy's ring on his hand? He walks back over, looks down at the ring around your hand. It's like, I don't know, it looks like it's worthless. And then he leaves you alone and he walks away.
And then I stifle my chuckles and I say, good thing my...
The door opens up. Did I hear a chuckle? I will double tap any of you in the head who are chuckling.
No, it's fine.
It shuts the door. It's fine.
Remember, you did get shot because you wouldn't shut up last time.
Hey, but then, all right, then at this time I very quietly whisper, hey. And then... I pull off my rogue's ring as I silently thank myself for having the foresight to have visited scamstuff.com, gear for the modern rogue. And I peel out the hidden shim inside of my rogue's ring, and I use the I pause momentarily to think, do I want to use the serrated edge to saw my way through the zip tie, or should I use the shim to shim my way out? I decide to saw. I saw, and the blade goes back and forth, and then finally I escape.
And then the door creeps open.
The whole time, man, this is the best I've felt since I went to scamstuff.com/products/the-rogues-ring.
You hear the door creep open again.
I freeze and hold my hands up like they're zip-tied still.
I heard a sawing noise. Somebody sleeping stopped snoring. Sounded a lot like metal against plastic or nylon. Whoever snores like that, stop. And then the door shuts again.
I mutter under my breath.
You'd have to be asleep to ignore these deals at scamstuff.com.
Brian's like, maybe I should have used the shim instead.
And so then, I reassemble my ring and I take a survey of my surroundings. What does the room look like?
There's about 30 or 40 other body bags on the ground.
But they're all filled with dead people though, right?
I don't know. Are they, Brian?
All right, I reach over to the nearest one. I kind of poke it.
Does nothing. There is like blood gushing out of that one. That may have been your fan.
Okay. So I get out of the bag and I tiptoe in the most comically over the top manner, tipping over body over body.
Now you hear footsteps coming back down the hall.
I real quick lay down and take one of the other bodies and roll it on top of me and I huddle up underneath.
The door opens up and somebody says there's an empty body bag laying in the middle of the ground here. And when did we get the fat one?
All right.
Is it floating already? Should I go poke that one with a stick? Because it's like twice the size of another one.
I steal my posture, ready to leap forward with leopard-like reflexes should they get too close.
You see him. You see his footsteps get closer and closer, and the boots, the droom, droom, and the breathing sound of the ventilator. Yeah, I think this one's bloated. What do? Do I just like poke it in the belly or whatever to let the gas out? I'll tell you what you need to do. Tune in next week on Journey Quest.
Ah! I'm back in the game, alive. I always knew I was alive. I never accepted that I was dead,
except for the whole part of being a ghost.
Yes, but outside of that.
Yeah. Listen, Brian, if you're a ghost, you wouldn't be able to do a product plug.
That's true. We all know the dead are beyond such mortal things. Hey, can I apply for the James Randi Educational Foundation $1 million challenge, even though it's terminated? Because I predict that all three of us are going to make our pick. Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange.
I actually have a different pick.
Oh, well, let's hear yours first.
My pick. Because I knew what everybody else was going to pick, and I think we'll have a longer discussion about that. If you've not already seen it, The Rick and Morty claymation non-canonical adventures. Have you watched these?
I have not. I've seen of them. I have not watched them yet.
They're like 20 seconds. They're super short claymation Rick and Morty. And if you need a little Rick and Morty fix, I highly recommend.
They're as long as like three vines.
Yeah.
So wait, so these are made by Adult Swim?
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, each one is a vignette riffing on a popular TV or movie property. So it's like just watched one that was 16 seconds long that ended with Rick looking like Michael Myers from the Halloween franchise.
Yeah. So you can watch all of them in a minute. So that's my pick. I'm just going to say it's out there. I don't know if you like Rick and Morty. I know Rick and Morty is like really most people don't like it. It's not very popular. I try to get my friends to watch it. And like, why did you make me watch
it? Well, yeah,
this?
If I remember right, you were way early on this. And you, it was me and Justin who was really resistant to actually give it a go.
I'm always way early on these things. Like, you know, I was like really into The Wire like 10 years after it aired. I'm the trend catcher, man. I am the trend catcher.
I know, yeah. Old early trend Andrew, who definitely didn't just sneer at me communist when he saw me watching The Wire while assembling magic tricks back when we moved.
I still feel that way. Yeah, I have a buddy who like I kept telling him, like, you gotta watch Rick and Morty. Like, I'll get around. And he watches other TV, so it's not like I'm like, no, dude, like, you don't understand. It's like, yeah, I'm like, how many times have I called you up about a cartoon? Like, I think Archer's cool, but I'm never like, dude, you got to watch Archer. Like, how many times have I ever done that? I'm like, he's like, oh yeah, it's right. And now he's like the biggest Rick and Morty fan in the world. I'm like, yeah, I don't make these recommendations lightly.
Yeah. So. It's a pretty fast hump to get over. You get three or four episodes in and I'm going to say any three or four episodes in any order. Like, I'm going to say, like, at that point you have acclimated to the idiosyncrasies of the show and that you're probably all in.
Yeah.
So rumor is December that they're going to hold to their promise to debut season 3 this year. So we might not be far away.
That would be amazing. Did you see the send up of Ex Machina?
Wasting your time talking to her. However, you would not be wasting your time dancing with her.
It's amazing.
Awesome. All right. I guess that's the end of picks, as I can't think of anything else that's really we want to call people's attention to. I mean, anything at all?
You know what? There's this indie movie. I don't know if you heard of it. I went and saw a Q&A with the writer last night at the Alamo Draft House because he lived up the road. I assume they were taking pity on him. But C. Robert Cargill showed up to take questions about his little movie called Doctor Strange. And it was, number one, just a delight to see Cargill again. And Cargill immediately was like, he was like, hey, man, I can't wait to come on the show. Not right now, though. The spotlight, the heat's too hot right now. But as soon as it dies down, I'm going to come back and be on the show with you guys.
Because that's the problem. The problem is that he can't come on the show and then not say something that, like, you know, that was his problem, is that he wound up saying something too interesting because he cannot hold himself back from saying interesting things.
Yes, exactly.
And it wound up with his sad mug in the New York Times apologizing.
But I'll tell you what, man. Doctor Strange, I think, is the most fun I've had in a Marvel movie since The Avengers. And before that, maybe the first Iron Man or the third Iron Man. Like it is definitely top five. Marvel cinematic or movie, Marvel anything, not the comic books, that I've experienced, full stop.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're just in a weird place with Marvel movies right now where, like, I feel like we're just getting less actual information out of us ranking our favorite Marvel movies, because at the end of the day, we're just all really excited that these movies keep happening and they continue to delight us and surprise us. So, like, I'm down with what you said, Brian. Like, for me, yeah, it's the most excited I've been at a movie in this genre since Guardians of the Galaxy. I guess I'm just so delighted that for a movie that I think very much could have not been a surprising movie. It was sort of constantly a surprising movie, and it constantly kind of delivered on levels that I wasn't expecting it to. And it was just the world building was great. The script, I think, is just so efficient for as much as it moves forward. It is just kind of relentless, which I think is great in a world where magical realism and fantasy and stuff like that can so very often just be ponderous, right? And this movie set up such a great universe. It moved us forward in a lot of these tropes that we've seen elsewhere. You know, we've seen underwritten villain guy. We've seen kind of too thin love interest lady. Like, but yet in this movie, it just felt perfect. Like it just kind of just kept humming along. Like by the end of it, we yet again get to spoiler alert, but shocker, the Marvel movie ends with a town being in peril, if not the entire world. And I'm like, all right, let's see what happens. And then another gigantic surprising thing happens that is so inventive and fun that I couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah, it took a lot of the tropes that we've come to expect from MCU properties. And I feel like it played the game super effectively. It's surprised. The hardest thing for a Marvel movie to do now is to surprise me. And I was surprised several times. I really enjoy. Have you seen it yet, Andrew?
I have.
Maybe you guys have read the comic books. I don't remember in the comic books them ever imbuing his cape with dog-like sentience that actually, you know, has affection and leads him to things and whatever. I thought that was a fantastic addition to the story.
Yeah, I think they did that because they didn't want the stone to be the kind of the solve everything sort of kind of like Doctor Who's TARDIS sort of became. You know, that's not their explanation they used, but that was sort of they wanted to sort of like downplay the idea of this all powerful magic amulet that very too frequently in the Doctor Strange comics kind of just solves the problem.
Sure, sure.
It was an interesting choice. So I'm going to give you my thoughts on Doctor Strange, if I may. I'm glad you guys have a love fest there. Glad you guys really enjoyed it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I'm glad that in this world that, you know, not everything's for everybody. And, you know, and there's the criticisms that, you know, that the Marvel well, that it's the same stop the bad guys before they get to point A and point B and point C and put the world into peril and the sort of the hero sort of journey kind of thing of smart ass guy finds his place. And there's certainly it's hard to sort of rebuke that criticism. My criticism, is, that I'm not watching it right now cause I loved it. I loved it. I was of the three of us, I was the one probably the most trepidatious and nervous about it being good. And because like, it's one of those things where, you know, Cargill and Derrickson are guys who are, as you personally know, and are talented people. I go like, yeah, the movies they've done haven't been really my kind of thing. I don't know. I was more nervous about this than I was in Ant-Man, and I loved Ant-Man. And I think this as a its thing, like I thought I called up Justin. I said, here's the thing about Doctor Strange. It's like, yes, it is. There's the very predictable sort of the MCU sort of plot point blind. And I knew that going into it. So that I couldn't go into it be like, well, I did. Like, I knew they were going to do that. So I'm okay. I thought, you know, the same sort of kind of hero's journey Tony Stark did, whatever. It's the same sort of journey. And it's all sort of the same sort of journey Peter Quill and many journeys. So I'm okay. Did they do it differently and entertaining? Absolutely. Visually, this is the most amazing superhero movie we have seen. This is visually the stuff that goes on here. My criticism of the first trailer was, well, it looks like a fan trailer made from Batman Begins and Inception. What I did not appreciate and what I did not realize was they were working on way more complicated effects that were not ready for the trailer. And when you see this movie and the stuff they do and the way, you know, it is really, they wanted to make a mind-bending Doctor Strange movie that takes what was so beautiful about the comics and sort of the ways that the, when the first origins of those comics and the way that world worked, how do you put that into film? I didn't see it in 3D because I said, I got to go see it no matter what. I am going to go see it in 3D next. It is so much like, I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but there is an entire, you know, in section there that you go, oh, this is brilliant. And I've never seen them do this. Like, so many movies you see, like, yes, I've seen this effect before. I've seen this sort of thing done before. But then the way that, like, it's like they took, it's like, yeah, it's like they watched Inception and said, this is cool. But what if we put a kung fu movie in the middle of Inception?
Yeah.
And you're like, so.
Yeah, man. I watched it in 2D, and I was glad to because I knew that, you know, I'd get to be there for the Cargill Q&A afterwards. But I could already tell, like, the moment we left. And by the way, it was late. We had a full day of shooting. We shot 4 episodes of The Modern Rogue yesterday. This thing started at 10 p.m. We knew we had an early day the next day. We were heading out, and Bonnie and I were like, ooh, so late. We normally just go to bed, right? Yeah, right. The moment that thing started, it was just suddenly 2:30 in the morning. It was insane. And I could tell that the moment it was over, I was like, well, I'm watching this again in 3D. Justin, you announced that it was 3D or bust for me, for you from the beginning. Was it, was it worth it? Did it deliver to the extent you had hoped?
Yeah. And really, if anything, I was so engrossed in the movie that I probably will pick up more when I see it again the next time. Because it certainly felt very, very immersive. I will say this. If you are going to see it, it's the only movie that I will recommend in 3D. So there's that. Number two, if you go see it, go see Digital IMAX. Digital IMAX got a bad rap because it was like the LIMAX thing where it wasn't really IMAX in terms of its size and dimensions and everything. It was just using a popular brand name that meant please pay us $4 more a ticket. But what Digital IMAX does obviously has a slightly larger format. But for 3D, the brightness and contrast is so much higher that it looks just slightly darker than a normal movie, as opposed to when you just see a regular 3D movie, which looks like you just kind of brought your iPhone down to 10% brightness on the home screen. So I would recommend it there. I think there's a sequence in this movie that is just so committed you see a few things floating around on Twitter before it opens this weekend. It's like, oh, stoner movie of the year or whatever, right? And you're like, oh, okay, I guess it's got some crazy visual effects. No, this is like one of the craziest like visual trip out sequences that I think has been in a movie that's going to make this much money. Like it is committed to being so insanely weird and inventive. And you're right, Andrew, you watch that trailer and you're like, well, okay, yeah, I mean, that's cool. Like, it's a Marvel version of Batman Begins and Inception. And then you realize that, no, they much in the famous story about Milton Berle, they only pulled out enough to win. and when they really open the kimono in this movie, it is just amazing.
There was in the Q&A I asked Cargill, I said, I would imagine in the writing process, there's certain scenes that were visualized exactly as you imagined them and others that that were not as you pictured them. But I assume, you know, hopefully surprised you in a positive way. And I asked for an example of each. He said that the minor spoilers, the scene where he's doing the astral projection battle while he's fighting for his life, he said, you know, it's a different villain than he originally had written because they had written the original script a different way. It wasn't one of the zealots. But he said that is pretty much note perfect for what he had expected. But the scene, again, slightly bigger spoiler, the scene with the in astral form, the last scene with the Ancient One and Doctor Strange, in time's essentially frozen, as they have their conversation, he said that was originally meant to be a fairly, I guess not much of a set piece at all. It was just supposed to be them hanging out in front of the awning, watching the rain as an ambulance slowly pulled up. But instead, if you know the scene I'm talking about, it's this strange, hypnotic, frozen slice of time that is all the more poignant for the visually dynamic elements all around it. And that is not at all what he intended when he wrote it. But the moment he saw it, he was like, "Oh yes, this captures the spirit and is so much better."
I think that there are so many scenes like that, so many things in there that just, they did such a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful job of, you know, executing, that were just done. And it's an example of, like, you know, I know that, like, it's frustrating for a lot of filmmakers to work with Marvel because Marvel does intervene. Marvel does do rewrites. Marvel does go in and say, we got to do this or whatever like that. But I would say it's like the Pixar thing where it just makes the stuff better and better and better. It's not like you go to a Marvel movie and you feel like the rewrites made it worse. You know, you feel like they just kept plussing it. And I thought that this was a movie that, like, there's a lot of exposition. There's a lot of, because we're stepping into this world of, it's like, you know, Harry Potter, like, you have to have, you know, it's an hour and a half before, like, the real plot kind of begins.
Yeah.
And because you got to build that, you know, and it's beautiful. It's wonderful because it's part of the stories. The real story is just Harry's journey to adulthood, you know. And I thought, like, here, like, they did some really clever ways to get that exposition and have other things happening, you know, when, you know, as he's, you know, a fight, you know, training sequence where they're training him, but they're also telling him something about this and setting up something that if you stay through the very end of the movie, you go, oh, wow, they laid the groundwork for this there. I think this movie, probably more than any other Marvel movie, maybe Captain America, has done the best to set up the later, what will happen later on.
Yeah. Man, you know, just 5 stars all around. Like, I think there's really not much more beyond just go to see it, because I think if we keep talking, we're just going to start talking about specific moments in the movie, right?
Yeah. How great they were.
The Chinese theater has the IMAX laser 3D tonight. I wondered if I should know.
Probably worth it.
I'll get some work done. I'll go do it tomorrow. I want to go, but I can go see it again. But yeah, totally going to go see the IMAX laser.
Awesome. Absolutely. Man, can't wait till, I mean, like, it's just this round of Marvel stuff. We wound up going out to dinner with a friend of ours, Ashley and I, and then just wound up watching scenes from Civil War and scenes from The Winter Soldier. And you just realize, like, wow, like, this factory, like, there's a reason why it is just making all of the money. And then you see, you know, you see the Guardians 2 trailer on the front of this, and it just gets this gigantic reaction. It's a great little teaser.
Oh, we did not get the Guardians 2 teaser.
We didn't get any trailers.
Yeah.
We did.
Oh, right on. Well, I'll have to go see it again.
And then, you know, you see something like the Fantastic Beasts trailer, which I don't really have tremendous hopes for Fantastic Beasts, and it's not because I don't think it's an insane universe. I think it's great. It certainly is rich enough that it should have these other stories being told within it. And I think Eddie Redmayne is a fantastic actor, but, you know, you watch that trailer and it's just sort of like, this is just sort of all universe. Like, that's kind of how you're selling the movie. You're really not selling the movie on a story. Now, listen, Doctor Strange didn't have the best trailer compared to what the final product was. I hope it's great. But when I watch Doctor Strange, I'm like, man, this is the Harry Potter story I want. Like, I want adult Harry Potter having to go through things and learning new facets of this broader world while he faces more menacing threats. Like, it's hard not to watch this. I mean, that was the biggest thing is coming out of it. Harry Potter, you know, the Kung Fu Harry Potter movie was the thing that immediately stuck in my mind. And as I congratulated Cargill on it, I was very happy to see him hit me back with a, you're welcome, FO. our episode the other week.
That's great.
I want you to think about, this thought. This is like, what, movie number 14 in the MCU?
Yeah.
Doesn't feel like it.
So we're at movie 14 in the MCU, and if we go look at what are the highest rated movies right now on Rotten Tomatoes, it has got a higher rating than Ron Howard's latest movie, than Mel Gibson, who is a fantastic director, crazy man sometimes, yeah, but as a director is amazing, that a Marvel movie is the highest rated movie out right now. Is kind of the movie number 14 in the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
And I would have said, I mean, to think that when they launched this thing, you know, almost, you know, when this franchise launched almost, you know, a little 10 years ago or so, that by the time we got to movie 14, we'd feel like, man, they're really getting characters down. They're really getting this thing down. They're really grasping, you know, the important parts. Like, and I think that we're knowing that, like, you know, as we get into the next phase of smaller stories, like Spider-Man Homecoming, that's like a John Hughes type film, and like, you know, where these things are going, it's going to be interesting. You know, the Ragnarok's supposed to be kind of a midnight run kind of thing. I'm excited. I'm really excited about where Marvel's going now, because we get the universe, we get the characters. Now it's like, you know, when I watched Daredevil season 2, I'm like, I could probably watch just a Daredevil courtroom drama series.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. Like, not even bother with the superhero stuff.
Yeah. You know, like, hey, you got some bruises on your face. Yeah, I did some thing last night. Anyhow, we've got this vigilante we need to defend, or the Kingpin's got this turn. I'm like, tell me more.
You know? Yep.
Let's get into these torts.
Yeah, that it's more exciting than a John Grisham novel now. You know?
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.